Hello everybody, a warm welcome to our podcast show, which launches the collaboration between Convivial Thinking and WITS Center for Diversity Studies, Johannesburg. Today, we have with us Melissa Steyn, who is the director of WITS Center for Diversity Studies, Johannesburg, Dr. Haley McEwen, senior researcher from the WITS Center for Diversity Studies, Aftab Nasir from Forman Christian College, Lahore, Pakistan, Julia Schweneberg, who also happens to be one of the founding members along with Aftab of the Convivial Thinking Group, and currently she is associated with the University of Kassel, Germany, and Dr. William M. Mufu, who is again a researcher from the WITS Center for Diversity Studies. And I, the host, Dr. Shayonde, currently working as a postdoctoral fellow at the WITS Center for Diversity Studies, Johannesburg.
So once again, a very good evening and afternoon, colleagues from the Convivial Thinking Collective and WITS Center for Diversity Studies. And it's a pleasure to have all of us together with respect to a conversation on the Convivial Thinking Collective and the Center for Diversity Studies, and also exploring some of the ways together that how can we come together and what are some of the things that we really can do together in the process of our collective projects. So let's begin with, you know, two fundamental questions. And the first is that what are some of the factors that actually led to the foundation of the very idea of critical diversity literacy, and what role it played along with other perspectives and other aspects as well that led to the foundation of the WITS Center for Diversity Studies. So if colleagues from the Diversity Studies Center can throw some points on it, maybe Melissa, you may begin, and then we can just move around to Haley and William.
Sure. So I suppose the origins of the thinking around critical diversity studies and then more specifically critical diversity literacy comes from the recognition of the importance of understanding the normative orders, the normative and dominant ways in which difference has been constructed through, well, we could say through the whole period of modernity, which has been on the basis of dominance and oppression, having been constructed from a very specific positionality of power. So we have this construction of the world in the image of a very small group of people, namely white European men, heteropatriarchal, heteronormative positionings too, with everybody else positioned as being the other. And I think what shifted in the last probably 40 odd years of social theory has been the recognition that we have to examine the normative position. In other words, not the positionality that's been constructed as the problem, but the ones that get away without being interrogated or being visible. So this is not such a new idea anymore. It's become pretty well accepted, I think, particularly through the work of critical whiteness studies, that, you know, the race has been constructed as something that Black people have that is a problem for Black people, but not for white people. And what we have found is that this gaze has been turned onto the normative position and understanding, no, actually, it's whiteness that is the problem from whence the power relations emanate. And so with critical diversity studies, the basic positioning has been that this same logic applies to all the major lines along which difference has been constructed, in a way that has really made a difference to people's lives. So it's race, but it's also gender, it's also sexuality, it's also able-bodiedness. All of these major fault lines that have shaped the idea of what is the normal and proper way of doing society. And what we've tried to do with critical diversity studies is to take the idea of diversity, which in and of itself really just means being different together, and taking it out of the framework that has also become normative, part of this normative order, which talks about diversity as something that we celebrate, something where we bring all the ways we differ together in a sort of a happy clappy kind of way. And we position our work in line with the critical tradition, which says that no, this is not about some sort of easy celebration. This is about struggle. This is about the struggle for a just and fair society, to deconstruct and reconstruct society along these lines of difference, in ways that will not be based on dominance and oppression and inequality. And so I think the whole logic of critical diversity studies is that this is about power relations. This is about how do we challenge unequal and unfair power relations that have become embedded and normalized within societies generally. And how do we resist these? How do we reframe these? How do we think about how we can make the changes in the ways in which we think about and understand difference? So I think that'll be my first shot at it. I'm going to leave Haley and William to come in and say more.
Great. Thanks so much, Melissa, for this very, very diverse and thought-provoking introduction to why critical diversity studies or why critical diversity literacy. And as I was here, thinking about the points that you raised here, like the questioning the normalized structures, just being different together, is something also which I feel very much reflects in the works of the colleagues from the Conway Weil Thinking Collective, and also from the colleagues from like William and Haley. So prior to going to our colleagues at the Conway Weil Thinking Collective, I would like to briefly know from William and then from Haley that how do their work actually bring these aspects of critical diversity studies on the forefront. If William, you can go ahead, and then we can just go ahead with Haley.
Yes, thank you, Cheyenne. I think one important observation that one can make about our work, on top of what Melissa has said, is that we daily hold the belief that these structures and systems of power can be challenged, and that change is possible, and that we can teach and learn from each other, which includes our students and our colleagues, the tools of how to challenge these structures and systems of power that daily press themselves against those that do not enjoy power, those that do not enjoy privilege, and those whose differences are systematically and structurally criminalized. So in that way, we have found ourselves really in the thickness of things involving struggles and efforts at decolonization and the struggle for the undoing of these stubborn structures and systems of power along the lines that Melissa has been describing, like gender, sexuality, religion, and other categories that include ableism and other exploitations and oppressions that are daily present in the lives of vulnerable people that happen to be majorities at a world scale. Yeah, I think that's one thing that one can add. And also that we invest a lot of emphasis in the critical part of our name and our work, insofar as we really take seriously the homework of questioning, and questioning even other texts on diversity. Other texts like the celebratory text, like the heritage text, and certain nativist texts that seek to narrow rather than widen and deepen approaches to opening up the world to differences and getting people to work and live together in difference, as Melissa just said right now. I think that's what I can add for now, Cheyenne and colleagues.
Great, William. And also, William, as you mentioned, as you were talking about the aspect of structures and systems of power, this is also something which I'm aware of is very much reflective in Haley's area of research as well, especially when she engages with gender, sexuality, and so many other intersectional aspects. So Haley, if you can just share how does your work with respect to various intersectional dimensions actually reflect the various aims and perspectives of critical diversity studies?
Thanks, Cheyenne. I mean, it's a great question. And I think what colleagues have already laid out about our work, it's brought us to an interesting point. So, I mean, one thing that I was thinking about that I wanted to also add about our work, I think, is just to contextualize it, in South Africa at this moment in time, and, you know, after the end of apartheid, you know, Melissa established the center at UCT in 2001, I think, Melissa. So it's very much been responsive to the needs of, you know, a society in, you know, the transformation process, decolonization process, that's trying to realize democracy and its promises. And I think that for me, I mean, coming from the United States, also to locate myself, I think, and in terms of the work I've been doing that has been looking at the rise of the anti-gender movement, is, you know, seeing things from the South Africa, a global South perspective, and also from a perspective here where, in many ways, I mean, we've spoken about it sometimes, like it's a pressure cooker in South Africa, or like we're at the coalface of so many of the kinds of inequalities that are, you know, structuring and fracturing our world. We're one of the most, if not the most unequal society in the world. We have like the highest rates of gender-based violence and femicide in the world. And just the extent to which the inequality, the gender-based violence, that it's, you know, racialized, is also very obvious. And I mean, these are dynamics we see shaping the world in many ways. So I think that, you know, also in terms of the work that we do in terms of methodology and the ways in which we, you know, shift the geographies of reason, so to speak, to think, you know, from critical perspectives, from perspectives, you know, thinking like from the margins, and how that enables us actually to speak, to name and identify and speak back to, power, essentially. So I think that the context of our work, like emerging from South Africa, gives us a lot of rich insights that are applicable not only to the South African context, but they they're really, you know, relevant and applicable, like Melissa's framework of critical diversity literacy, for example. It's so relevant to understanding global dynamics. So I think that's also what we're wanting to do, is to be able to offer this kind of unique but powerful way of interrogating forms of power, privilege, and oppression that we can interrogate, like, at local contexts all the way up to, you know, global geopolitical kinds of power relations. So I think I'll stop there. Thanks, Cheyenne.
Great. Thank you so much, Haley, for, you know, extending the and building on the conversation that was started by Melissa and William. And as, like, I have been listening to all the three of you and was just thinking of some of the key points that you just raised through your reflections, like, you know, thinking from the margins, contextualizations, and already the other points which I've already mentioned, like questioning the normalized structures and systems of power, etc. It just was coming across my mind that there are so many overlaps that I can already see in the context, in the works of our Convivial Thinking Collective. So just to carry forward the conversation, I would like to ask my colleagues, maybe Aftab can start, and then we can move on to Julia. So, I mean, what, according to you as individuals, is the very notion of convivial thinking? How do you understand it? How do you look at it from your respective positions? And how did the various notions of Convivial Thinking Collective actually came together to lay the very foundation of this particular collective? If Aftab can start.
Thank you, Cheyenne, and thanks to Melissa, Haley, and William for their insights. I already agree that there are many overlaps that we can already see. So just a brief history of convivial thinking itself. It was more of a conversation between two colleagues sitting over a cup of tea and wondering how as you guys already mentioned, how different sources of power are very much homogenized within our academia, how alternate voices do not get any room for publication or for any platform where they could be amplified. So that's where me and Julia started thinking differently about how we can start a collective that would be a platform for alternate thinking, alternate models of development, alternate models of being. So we ended up talking more and more about post-colonial literature, post-development literature, even decolonial thinking. So that's where we kind of situate ourselves. In the beginning, that's where the debate started. And more so over the period of time, we started inviting people from different languages writing for our convivial thinking, because we believe that language itself is hegemonic in many ways, in the sense that producing and reproducing in English or any international language also sort of debars the whole debate. So, and then, over the period of time, Cheyenne, Lata, and many others joined us, and we had a collective that was inclusive in its structure, to say the least, or at least we try to make it as inclusive. And we always focus on this non-North-centric approach towards the whole debate of trying to listen, trying to understand different dimensions of development and then modes of being. So my question would be, you can take it as a question or as a comment, that the more I hear, maybe then that would become clearer, that it seems to me that critical diversity studies is akin or close to, say, post-colonial studies as well. So how do we depart, or is there a thin line difference, or do you really depart yourself from the debates? That would be my submission. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much, Aftab, for this, you know, for this brief and very insightful introduction and for the question. Surely we will have discussions. And but prior to that, I can already see that Melissa is there, you know, who is raising her hand. Just allow me, Melissa, to go quickly to Julia, and so that she can also share some of her thoughts about the Kanvi Viral Thinking Collective, and then obviously we can just, you know, make it a kind of discussion forum just after this brief introduction. Yes, Julia, if you can quickly add some more words along with what Aftab has just introduced.
Yes, thank you so much, Shayun. Thanks for bringing us together, because that's in fact also part of what we're trying to do as a collective, you know, to reach out, to be in conversation with others beyond the bubbles that we usually inhabit. And I also very much appreciated the way you phrased your question when you asked Aftab and I about our like very individual and personal notions of convivial thinking, because that's indeed what it is, that we believe to what we hope to be like a collective of many different voices. And this, as Melissa said, there's no easy celebration, but of diversity or of different viewpoints, of different positionalities. But we believe that we can still, you know, come together in a joint struggle, exactly what colleagues from WITS have pointed out, against dominance and oppression and the very single story and the very single narrative of Western dominance and the Westernized worldview. So from my point of view, I'm coming from the belief that what the Zapatistas of Mexico have famously quipped, that another world is possible. And I believe that it's not only possible, but it's already existing. In fact, in these kind of spaces where people come together to question, to deconstruct structures of power and oppression, and to reconstruct alternatives to that. So from my point of view, like conviviality, and there are many definitions of conviviality, or like being modes, different alternatives, non-Westernized ways of being, as Aftab has said. I believe that, well, at least my motivation of being involved in the collective is to work towards the pluriverse, towards a world in which many worlds fit, but worlds that are in conversation with each other, that do not take up each other's space, but that can still be very particular and very contextual. So what we hope to contribute to with the work and the interactions and the exchanges we have in the collective is to contribute to this joint struggle, as colleagues have said, but also to build a space and a network, or Arturo Escobar talks of a meshwork, which I even think is a much nicer word than a network, because it more illustrates the entanglements of all of us. So this meshwork of solidarity, of reciprocity, and of conviviality. And in all of that, what's obviously vital is the critical reflection of own privilege and own position. So what we hope to do, hope to contribute to, and hope to experience very individual, but also as a group, as a collective, is to have like a joint journey of learning and unlearning. And in, as I understand, in contrast to the WITS Center, the collective is very much outside of like formal institution or formal academic structures, somewhat as a counterpoint, as a more like individual, independent kind of body where people can meet, but at the same time still questioning the institutions and structures that maintain certain knowledge and power divides, especially in academia, but also, as Aftab has said, also beyond in all kinds of living and being and in relation with each other.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much, Julia. And you as usual, like, you know, raised some very, very important points for us to engage with further, especially the one of the most important points you raised is, you know, being a part of an institution, working under the principles of an institution and working independently. And I think, you know, two spaces coming together from these two diverse points is actually what opens up for opens for all of us a bigger possibility of, you know, creating intersections of different points of view, and also what you mentioned about the meshworks of solidarity and reciprocity. Now, taking this conversation forward from these, you know, different interactions and intersections of so many diverse viewpoints, I would like to invite Melissa to, you know, respond to Aftab's question, and then we can go ahead with the conversation further.
Yeah, thank you, Shine. And thank you both of our new colleagues for those very powerful insights. And I must just say, I'm sure I can speak for Hayley and William too, by just saying there's just so much that resonates with our work and with the kinds of values and aspirations that we espouse. So this is very exciting. I did just want to respond to what Aftab asked about our relationship to post-colonial studies. And, you know, the way I think about it is that it's really a matter of what you foreground and what you background. So it's really a matter of perspective. And on the one hand, you could see the work we do as all fitting broadly under, I suppose, what we would say a decolonial framework, in that we are working against these normative structural patterns of oppression that have been shaped through colonial modernity. And so on the one hand, you could see it as working quite specifically for that agenda. On the other hand, our focus is somewhat more is less upon a particular theoretical positioning. It's less upon putting ourselves within a particular theoretical tribe, if I can say it that way. Because we work with, you know, all the theories that have emanated around the lives and positionings of marginalized people. So a post-colonial theory, decolonial theories, this becomes part of the tools that we use, but it doesn't define our work. In that we would say that this is, you know, is that everything falls within that framework. What we do is the work that comes out of critical disability studies, for example, the work that comes out of queer theory, for example, you know, these are starting points for us to think about the ways in which those particular dynamics of difference have been constructed and perpetuated. And we take those theoretical traditions very much as part of what shapes what we are. So I suppose you could say that theoretically we're very intersectional. Theoretically, we don't draw specifically only on like feminist analysis. But our work would absolutely not be possible without a deep and thorough understanding and engagement with feminist work. So it's really, I think, as I say, it's sort of like about, you know, we could answer that question in different ways depending on how we frame it. But we would not be able to do our work without the many important insights that come out of both post-colonialism and decolonialism. But those aren't the only theoretical trajectories that shape what we are. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely, Melissa. And while I was listening to you, obviously, I mean, after me, Aftab can come in and then we can move on to Julia. But while I was listening to you, I think the very perspective of intersectionality is something which is so crucial for us to understand, to, you know, implement both the notions of convivial thinking and critical diversity studies in our habitual ways of existence, and especially the intersection that invites us not to fit ourselves within definite theoretical compartments, but to be fluid enough to embrace each other's knowledge. Maybe, I don't know, Aftab, do you have any quick comment on what Melissa has said? And otherwise, we can just move to Julia.
Thank you, Sayan. Just a brief comment. I just want to thank Melissa for such an elaborate response. Just to appreciate that, yes, this is exactly what in the making of this whole collective itself was inherent, that we do not become victims of some big buzzwords and try to build a niche where we could do something. So I'm very happy that the way Melissa explained how, the in a way, that is an extension of the works, and I would say a genuine contribution in the local indigenous decolonial world. So yeah, I just want to thank Melissa for such an elaborate response.
Thank you so much, Aftab. And so let's move on to Julia. Yes, Julia, please go ahead.
Yeah, I can only second Aftab, because I sometimes in recent discussions with colleagues in academia and conferences, I have gained the impression that decolonizing the decoloniality and post-colonial theory has become something of a buzzword, something that is very fancy, and that's also very easily co-opted. And a lot of the work being done under the decolonial or the post-colonial label is very much lip service. So if we look at the, you know, all the debates about decolonizing the curriculum, I often fear that, you know, the decolonizing is basically kind of completed with the act of including just a few more readings from more diverse authors, but not actually tackling the structures and institutions that, you know, should be deconstructed and reconstructed in a different way for the decolonizing to happen. And in that sense, I also feel that, you know, decolonizing should always be, you know, a process and not an event, not something that, oh, you know, decolonization has happened. Now we, the university or academia or whatever has been decolonized. And I think, Melissa, what you laid out in terms of drawing on different voices, I think that's very much vital in terms of, you know, really questioning whose voices are, you know, are important and whose voices are so far marginalized or silenced, or whose knowledges are not at all heard, and bring in this assemblage of different possessions, of different viewpoints. all the while, I also feel that sometimes it's a little bit of a difficult negotiating ground and a little bit of a struggle between the giving lots of voices and listening and learning from many different voices, but on the other hand, not essentializing and relativizing in the good intention of giving everyone the space. So I think part of the many conversations we are also having in the collective is about like finding the somewhat normative frames, maybe about what can mean a good life, if you want to say that, for all, to avoid the term of development, all the while making sure, yes, there can there be a good life for all, all the while kind of avoiding that there's some kind of prescription or some kind of dominance in terms of who's defining what this good life might mean. So I think there's also here we're kind of trying to do, and the conversations we're having, there's also a little bit of this tension in terms of not applauding or praising all kinds of different viewpoints, but still taking the time to to listen and reflect, and maybe also to unlearn unexpected new things that might come to oneself from basically just trying to take a different position.
Thank you so much, Julia, for raising such important points. And one very crucial point which you actually put forth is that, and which also Aftab also mentioned, that decoloniality should not be just a buzzword or a form of event, but it is a continuous process. And this is also something which indirectly, without mentioning the term decoloniality, also at the very beginning, Melissa, William, and Haley were also talking about. So this actually provokes me to ask all of you a common question. Also, I think this is something which is also going to give the listeners a kind of background that what exactly we are planning to do together. And that is that at the very grassroots level, and this question keeps on haunting me, that at the very grassroots level, at the social level, cultural level, personal level, familial level, and various other grassroots level, how do we create this awareness towards the process, towards this habitual process of decolonization in our daily life? I mean, obviously, we are talking so much about decolonization within classrooms, through activisms, both online and physically, through conferences, workshops, publications, and so many other aspects. But this very aspect of the grassroots level work of decolonization still needs a lot of interventions, lot of diversity. So how, as a collective, not just the Convivial Thinking Collective, but also this collective of the Center for Diversity Studies, addresses this very aspect of bringing in the consciousness towards a process of decolonization at the very grassroots level? And anybody, just feel free to just come in and share your thoughts. I don't know if William, Haley, or Aftab, Julia, Melissa, anybody would like to just come in?
I think you're going to have to finger somebody, Shan.
Okay, great. I mean, then Melissa, you may start with, and then we can just move ahead.
Okay, I didn't think you'd do that. All right. The awareness. So I suppose in some ways you could say that our work fits into the Freirean framework of raising consciousness. So yeah, that very much is part of what we set about to do. We have developed, that Hayley mentioned, this framework of critical diversity literacy, which tries to identify key aspects of what a person who is working with difference, who is living in a world of difference, in other words, that's all of us, would need to possess. It's really like a kind of a stance towards difference. And it tries to identify key themes, as it were, that have emerged out of contemporary social science generally, critical social science, of what we need, how we need to be aware, how we need to live, how we need to behave, I suppose. And the work that we do tries to develop this critical diversity literacy with the people that we have contact with, the students, communities that we've worked with. Let me leave that as my contribution there.
Great. Thank you so much, Melissa, for that brief reflection on the grassroots aspects of how we can bring decoloniality at the very basic ground. Maybe may I just invite Aftab for a quick reflection. Aftab, would you like to share some points?
Thank you, Sayan. I would say, on the expense of sounding, I would say, pardon me for putting in another perspective on it. So my trouble with this is the question itself, that we are trying to make this consciousness happen in the lives of many who may already be living under their diverse, fluid, juxtaposed social realities. And my problem is that whenever I try to think about how can I sort of give them the consciousness, I shy away from the fact, because it looks in itself an interventionist, same top-down approach to me. So I guess for me, this has always been a question of de-learning. How can I sort of, as a thinker, how can I first of all theorize diversity for myself, and then make other people see what diversity means, what conviviality means, what development means, et cetera, so on and so forth. So please pardon me for rather sort of questioning the question itself, that why do we assume in the first place that consciousness needs to sort of go down? Is it not the other way around? Maybe we need to learn the consciousness.
No, absolutely. Aftab, there is no question of pardoning, because that's just your way of addressing the question. And as you put it, questioning the question actually opens up so many important points for us to, you know, engage with. And I totally appreciate the point you raised, that why do we really need to, you know, think about, to bring it down to the grassroots level, rather than, you know, indulging in the opposite way of learning. And I think it kind of also invites all of us to think about that, how this very challenges that we are currently facing with respect to the very metaphorization of the very notion of decoloniality. And that is something we were just talking about as a buzzword, as a just a form of an event, just actually opens up another space in front of us, that how can we de-link ourselves from this problem. And thank you so much, Aftab, you know, for bringing these very crucial reflections in front of us. And to carry this very interesting conversation forward, may I invite William to share some insights about it?
Okay. Thanks, Cheyenne and colleagues. And I think what we are engaged with here already is a questioning of the questions like what Aftab has just said, and also a kind of project of looking inside ourselves and how we are showing up in this work that we have elected to do. And it's important that we remind ourselves of the important sensibilities that we need to guard against reducing decolonial work or liberation work into slogans, into buzzwords, into catchphrases, and other sort of diversionary currents. And also to avoid just keeping it academic work, because there is a challenge of such work as this just becoming academic, just becoming intellectual, to the negligence of the social justice task ahead. So it is important to realize that over and above interrogating theories, interrogating methods, and splitting hairs about what this theory says and what another theory says and how to tease out ideas from this theory and that theory. At the end of the day, the big work is beyond just academic work of ticking boxes and reporting what we have done and what we have written, what we have said and what we have achieved. But how does what we think and what we do daily feed into the social justice project out there, not at the vulnerable people out there, but with the vulnerable people out there, not preaching at them, not talking at them, but walking and working with them towards that. I like what the other colleague did by citing the work of the Zapatista as an example of a decolonial movement at a certain level. So I think we are already interrogating our own work and how we're carrying it out. And it's important for us to do that before we engage in any work together and all that.
Great. Thank you so much, William, for these points. And I can already see, Haley looking forward to come in and share some thoughts. Yes, please, Haley.
Thanks so much, Cheyenne. Yeah, and I think what I just want to add quickly is, I just think that these kinds of conversations are just so meaningful and productive, and they really, require us to get off of this productivity train where, with the privatization and commercialization and massification and everything of higher education and the demands that are on, placed on academics I've just been thinking throughout this conversation about, the move towards what they call slow knowledge is slow research, that sort of thing, where, it's important to recognize that there is value in thinking in itself and having conversations. And it's quite nice to have a space for that because we don't actually get those kinds of spaces very often. There's always an expectation of an output, right? Of something that's, been produced, like publications. And I'm not saying, of course, that we should not do that, because it would be awesome if we did. And it's great, whatever we do together, will be awesome. But also just, recognizing, and I think in the name of your collective, the Convivial Thinking Collective, it just really calls attention to the importance of thinking, engaging, and feeling our way through these things together. And also, in having disagreements, in having tensions between us and having those kinds of productive debates and conversations. So thank you. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Haley, because and altogether after listening to all of us in this discussion, one thing that comes to the forefront is why it is very necessary every time for all of us to unsettle ourselves from the zones of comfort and try to be close to the practical realities of existence and draw our inspirations towards theorizing and philosophizing from there. And now, may I just invite Julia to quickly share some points, and with that, we can just wrap up this really fascinating conversation. Julia.
Yeah, thanks. Well, while listening to William and Haley, I was thinking about when William said, well, we need to, you know, avoid it becoming only academic work. And I was thinking, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, obviously, this differentiation between, you know, the academic realm, which is supposedly, you know, measurable, which is happening in peer-reviewed journals, which is happening in publications in a certain language, as Aftab has said, like mostly in English. So maybe, you know, part of our, you know, joint engagements or also the work we do individually is also to kind of think about, you know, why do we need this? Obviously, I realized, you know, there's the neoliberal university, there are the systems of higher education that dictate that. But to a certain extent, we can decide not to play along with that and really also, you know, appreciate knowledges and appreciate interventions that are coming from outside the university that are not voiced in these specific realms, that are not phrased in terms of outputs and outcomes and objectives and etc. To also appreciate them as very valuable and very needed contributions. And I think that's maybe also, especially as a group of people who are obviously involved in academic realms, to keep that in mind and not, you know, just focus on that. Coming back to your question, Cheyenne, I was kind of stuck with when you asked about the grassroots level, because I was thinking, you know, what is the grassroots level actually, and especially, you know, also linking to what Aftab has said, and it brought me back to this, basically to, you know, questioning what is my role, what is my position, and what are also my privileges as a white, well-educated, very, you know, privileged woman living in Germany, and how can I deconstruct and also talk, you know, to others around me, you know, in my daily in my daily interactions about how I or how, you know, family, friends, people like me are kind of implicated, entangled, and also complicit in certain structures of, you know, of power divides, of power asymmetries, of oppression, and start, like, basically on a day-to-day process, start reflecting and unlearning some of that. So I would, you know, the grassroots is such a difficult terms, and you know, thinking about, you know, the history of development interventions, and I guess that's what also Aftab had in mind when he responded. But at least for me, with my very specific positionality, which I feel is very, very privileged, I think the starting point is actually basically, you know, at home. Very literally at home, but also in my community, in my university, in my, you know, in the community groups I'm involved in, and with my friends, etc. So very practically have these conversations there, and then feed that back and forth with the in academic realm, obviously, too.
Thank you so much, Julia, for, you know, bringing another very interesting argument about the very notion of grassroots. And this just actually, you know, opens up so many more questions in front of us to engage with. And as Aftab and William also just previously mentioned about questioning the very questions that we live with on a daily basis. And another very crucial point I also find in your reflection, Julia, is actually, and also which is something which Aftab also mentioned a few moments back, that the very moment when we ask a question for the society, it is very necessary for us to put that question to our own self and be honest to our own self if we are reflecting on it together in the most honest way possible. So with these very interesting points, so many interesting and intersectional dimensions that actually have come to the forefront in our conversation today. And I'm pretty sure that just gives us enough food for thought to build our next conversations. And as we continue till then, I just wish to thank all of you, Julia, William, Aftab, Melissa, and Haley, for being a part of this fascinating conversation, raising such so many important issues and sharing such important points. Thank you so much once again, all of you.